Well, thanks very much for inviting me. I'm going to begin, and my paper will turn around a paper of Ned Hall's that Sarah Bernstein was talking about in the last session. So that was either marvelous coincidence or the power of the morphogenetic field at work. Hall has a very well-known argument that there are perhaps two kinds of causation, two concepts, he says, but the concepts are picking out two things which are pretty clearly different kinds of relations in the world. I'll begin by running through a kind of a highly edited and perhaps slightly tweaked version of the argument in just a few slides for those of you who aren't familiar with it. So the idea is you should begin by agreeing to a whole shopping list of appealing principles about causation, claims about causation that just seem to say something very important about the way causality works. Here they are. Locality, the idea, well, we also heard about this today, of course, that when causation happens, when a causal arrow goes from a cause to an effect, it has to take a route through space and time. Okay, so there's no leaping over spatio-temporal voids in causation. Intrinsicness, the idea that what makes a process causal is something to do with the things that are actually intrinsic parts of the process itself. Transitivity, okay, well, that's what transitivity is, that one thing is a cause of another, the other is a cause of something further, then the first thing is a cause of the something further also, okay? Dependence, that is counterfactual dependence in this case, is sufficient for causation. And finally, that absences, or as they're called in this literature, omissions, can be both causes and things that are caused. Okay, so here's a little example for you. Somebody's not feeding the fish can cause their death. So something that doesn't happen, a non-feeding can cause a death. And that non-feeding may have been caused by a blow to the head. So Gödel, as we know, murdered Schmidt. Schmidt was therefore unable to feed the fish. The non-feeding of the fish in this case seems to have been something that was caused, yet it, again, is an absence, an omission. Okay, so I didn't say anything to motivate those, and I'm not going to try to motivate them. I'll let them stand on their appeal. But they are all things that people have said in very forthright and strident terms about causation. So they seem to be the kinds of fixed truths that we use in philosophy, where we're stuck in the armchair because we have no metaphysics scopes to see what the ultimate structure of reality really is. The kind of things we use in the armchair to adjudicate metaphysical disputes, they seem to be the fixed axes around which metaphysical endeavors in philosophy revolve. Now, Ned Hall's contribution is to argue that these five theses can't actually all be true of the same thing. So he poses what I call a pentalemma, right? You've got to choose between them. So it seems. Here are some reasons to think, why you might think this. Omissions or absences are not spatio-temporally connected. So if we insist on locality, we have to give up on the causal efficacy or ability to be affected of absences. Counterfactual dependence does not turn on the intrinsic features of a process. The way things are outside the process can affect whether there's counterfactual dependence or not. In particular, most relevant to this kind of literature, backup causes, standing in reserve, can make a difference to whether there's dependence. And this, not a straight out objection to all these things being true at the same time, but certainly a potential roadblock, counterfactual dependence is not transitive. Okay, I won't, again, rather than explaining the argument in any further detail, let me just ask you to see that there is at least an incipient problem here, that it looks like we're not going to be able to get a single relation of causation that satisfies all of these five things. And of course, you might want to add to the list, and that might make it even more difficult still to find something that satisfies every item on it. So we've got to make a choice. Natural choice in the metaphysics of causation and metaphysics generally, in philosophy generally, is that you, what seemed so appealing at first glance turns out, once you realize it's inconsistent with your own theory, to be obviously false. And philosophers are good at this. But it's a very local effect, and the rest of the philosophical audience tends not to go along, right? But still, that's the usual situation here is philosophers, even as a body, will say, okay, we've got to give up on some of these, now we simply have to decide which ones. Which are the illusions, the mistakes, the seductive, ultimately disastrous blunders, and which are the pole stars of metaphysics that are going to guide us to the truth about causation. That's one way to deal with this. But the other way to deal with it is to multiply causal relations, to think, well, maybe all the theses are true, but they're not all true of the same thing. There's really more than one kind of causation out there, and some of the theses are true of some kinds, and some are true of other kinds. We weren't dumb or wrong to think that there was something right about these theses, although we were wrong to think that there was a single thing that they were all speaking correctly about. And that, as you will have been able to predict, is Hall's suggestion here. The idea is to draw a line down the middle of our causal talk, and down the middle of reality too, and say, there's two kinds in this case, the minimal solution, I suppose, the minimal multiplication of one is two. Two kinds of causal relations. There's a relation of production, which will be local, intrinsic, and transitive. And there's a relation of, I'll call it, difference-making. And that's the relation that counterfactual dependence is sufficient for, that links omissions, absences, and so on. It may or may not be transitive, depending on exactly what it turns out to be. I think Ned Hall himself would say it's not transitive. Okay? So, two concepts of causation, picking out two different kinds of relation, two kinds of things in the world which qualify as causal. So that's a kind of an interesting and different and exciting way to solve the pentalemma, I think. But it does bring some problems. Assuming that this is a genuine metaphysical discovery, that we didn't know all along that we were talking about two kinds of things, and that is a very natural reaction here, because the idea there are two kinds of causation seems a little shocking at first, then we're going to have to accept a whole list of consequences that look like critical consequences for what we've been doing all along, that are when we've been talking about causes without putting little subscripts on the ends of our words, we've been talking ambiguously, that perhaps our intuitive metaphysics of causation is false, and once you take a step down that road, of course, you might start wondering about all five of those principles, and even about the very existence of causality itself. We'll have to do a lot of disambiguation of the entire philosophical literature on causation, and also potentially the entire literature on causation, including everything in science that makes causal claims, have to go through production or difference-making, or maybe both. Production or difference-making, maybe both, for every scientific paper that's ever been published. So it would be a lot of work. And I became a philosopher because I'm a little bit lazy. So I'm wondering, are there any alternatives? On the one hand, I like the whole argument. I like the idea of keeping the theses by making a distinction. On the other hand, I'm a little bit worried about all this stuff. And this paper today is going to be about an alternative that, on the one hand, accepts the broad lines of the argument and accepts the kind of strategy that's used to resolve the pentalemma, that is distinguishing two kinds of causal relations. But that doesn't do what Hall looks to be doing, which is simply distinguishing two somewhat independent relations that are almost, as it were, competing for our attention, competing to be talked about. So let me explain what that alternative is. Okay. In my one thing, two aspects way of thinking about what's going on, there's just a single kind of basic causal stuff. And I call it causal influence. It's a little bit of a term of art, but it's also a term that's been used before by a whole bunch of people, David Lewis, for example, but I think many people before him, in a way that more or less goes along with the way I'm using it here. So a term of art, but not just a term of art. So all of the causal matter in the world, using this term matter in a slightly metaphorical sense, of course, but insofar as we're doing metaphysics, we're doing ontology here, the question is, what are the basic building blocks? I'm talking about those blocks. All of the basic causal building blocks together comprise a web of these causal influence relations. Okay, and that's it. If you ask me for a complete inventory of causal reality and I give you the web of influence, then I've discharged your request. I'm done. However, there are two ways of talking about the web. There's influence talk, and then there's difference-making talk. Okay? One thing, the web of influence, and two aspects. Okay? The basic stuff, influence, and this other way of talking, which is, as I put it here, a high-level or abstract way. Maybe not very high-level, but higher than influence. Where we pick out certain aspects of that structure, of the web, okay? And so alongside causal influence, I want to tell you about this other thing, causal difference making, which is just my name, again, a term of art, but also one that has a long history of being used in more or less this way, for this other relation that we're pointing to when we indulge in this abstract or high-level talk. Okay, so the picture is a little bit like the picture you have with, say, mass and center of mass. Okay, the basic facts when it comes to mass, just the facts that determine the distribution of mass throughout the universe. Okay, but we also have this notion of a center of mass, a somewhat more abstract notion. Claims about center of mass are made true or false simply by the basic mass facts. But often the centers of mass can, center of mass talk is extremely useful to us for doing physics. And often, indeed, we can start to reify a little and forget that really what we're doing all along is just talking about the basic stuff. Individuals and populations in biology, perhaps, is another example of this sort of thing. Okay. I also want to suggest, I have to admit, I won't really be arguing for this today, that we've known this all along. So this is not a surprising discovery about the nature of causality. It's a distinction that's built into the way we've always thought about and talked about causality. And we make these distinctions, or at least we make these distinctions when we need to disambiguate, although, as you'll see, for the most part, our talk is about the difference-making relation, even though it's the non-basic relation. And so the presumption is that's what people mean when they make causal claims, unless there's some special context to suggest otherwise. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about causal influence, as I think of it, and then I'll talk some about causal difference-making. I'll come back and put them together, and that will be the one thing, two aspects theory. I'll be done for today. Causal influence, what is this bedrock on which everything is built? Well, by stipulation, in effect, influence is the fundamental causal stuff. Here's something a little bit more informative. Influence is the relation by way of which one thing has some effect on what another thing does. Now, that's not supposed to be a philosophically bulletproof definition. It's supposed to get you thinking about the kind of thing influence is. Another way to get you thinking about what I'm talking about here is to give you an example. So in Newtonian physics, I think, causal influence is just force. Okay, gravitational force, or in the extensions of Newtonian physics, electrical force or magnetic force, and so on. Okay, so this influence is just that's the basic stuff by way of which the way things are in one place changes the way things are in another. In modern physics, well, we don't really know, the facts aren't in about modern physics yet, but potential is one starting place if you want to think about the appropriate analogy, the appropriate story about what influence is in the physics we have now on our plates. Once we figure out how gravity figures all into it, we'll be able to say something a bit more definitive, I hope. Okay, so let me continue with the Newtonian case, because at least there we know what theory we're dealing with. The idea is there's a causal influence relation for every component force. Or maybe I should say, at least this is how we read the physics, naturally. Okay, we ordinary human beings. Okay, there are philosophers of physics who think maybe we shouldn't read it that way, but this is how we naturally think about it. So we think there's one of these causal relations in this case, given in Newtonian gravitational theory, for every pair of bits of mass, whatever the fundamental carrier of mass is, okay? Two particles or whatever, each having a bit of mass, they're influencing one another at all times. And that's true for all pairs in the universe at any time. Okay, so it's a very prolific thing, this causal influence. There's a lot of it. If you had to draw the web of influence, it would take you a long time, even for something fairly simple. And in fact, it would barely even look like a web at all. Your paper would be so densely filled in. The web is really just a metaphor here for a very, very dense set of relations, a denseness on the order of the continuum. Okay, so yes, you say, but what actually is causal influence? And my strategy is not to tell you. I don't see myself as somebody who has a particular story about the metaphysics of causal influence. There's a whole lot of ways you might go. You might give a kind of a regularity theory where you identify influence with a certain kind of nomological dependence and then do the metaphysics of laws in a regularity-based way. You might give a kind of a process view of causal influence. I think, in fact, this is the natural territory for process views of causation. What they really are is theories of causal influence. Okay, so whether it's marked transmission or conserved quantity or what. You might even give a counterfactual theory. I don't think this is quite the right way to go, but it's certainly an idea that could be developed. If you're going to do that, it would have to be counterfactual dependence between what Hempel called concrete events, maximally fine-grained events, events individuated by all of the intrinsic features of the pockets of space-time where they unfold. Okay. So the short story here is this really, I left out, of course, there's always the primitive theory. There's just fact of the matter about which things influence what. Although I think on any of these stories, it had better be the case that the laws, the fundamental laws of nature, have a lot to say about what influences what, either very directly, because nomological dependence is built in, or because they play a big role in, for example, determining the truth values of the counterfactuals. Okay. So there's lots of different metaphysical stories you could give. All I require is that, however the metaphysics goes, there is such a thing as causal influence. Or maybe I don't even require that. Maybe all I really need, if I'm going to be more of an anthropologist than a philosopher, is that we think there's a relation of causal influence. But for the rest of this talk, let me not be so indirect. Let me just say, all we need as causal thinkers is that there are causal influences. We somehow read them off the physics, either in a very direct way, if causal influence is directly determined by nomological dependence, or maybe a rather indirect way if a lot of other things are playing a role as well. For example, a direction of entropy increase or something like that. Okay, this doesn't, causal influence, the metaphysics of causal influence, does, as you can see, does not have to be primitive. It can be quite complex, it can be quite Humean, it could even be a kind of projectivist metaphysics. What I really want to talk to you about, of course, is this other difference-making way of thinking about the web of influence and how the two go together. But a little bit more on influence itself first, in case you're getting nervous about one thing or another. Okay, so I'm supposing that on, at least on the standard views, the facts about influence are going to depend on the facts about causal influence, about fundamental physics. Don't think, however, that therefore you need to be some kind of superphysicist to know what causally influences what. All of us know facts about influence, multiple, manifold facts about influence, not because we've seen the fundamental equations, but simply because we have good enough heuristics for deciding when one thing influences another. Okay, even a kid watching the weather vane blow in the wind can see that there's causal influence going on, though they can't build a physical model of it, let alone reduce it all to quantum mechanics. Okay, and causal influence talk, it almost never happens. So even though causal influence is all there is to causation, we almost never talk about it directly. Sometimes, we may occasionally, usually in artificial situations, the movements of Mars affect the trajectory of the dropped pen, for example. I suppose that could be an influence claim, but it's not the sort of thing that people go around saying to one another. Here's a slightly less bizarre sounding example. I might say the Earth's magnetic field influences charged particles coming in from outer space. And there I'm talking about this direct influence connection. But most of the time that's not what I'm talking about. Most of the time what I'm talking about is causal difference making. And the reason is that it's the causal difference makers that are the explainers. And I think it's also the causal difference makers for that very reason that we pick out with, that we call causes, and that we pick out with our attributions of causation. So when I say C was a cause of E, and I say the rocks hitting the jar broke it, that's a claim about difference making. Also a claim about explanation. Okay, so all of the regular talk about causation that philosophers are trying to analyze, that's a little strong. The kind of talk about causation that all the philosophers working on singular causation are trying to analyze, the kind of talk, the kind of theorizing that worries very much about preemption, about redundant causation, about double prevention, all of that is an attempt to figure out what's going on with causal difference making. Okay. So what is it? I like to begin, or I like to think of my precursor in giving the two-aspect story of causation as being Wesley Salmon. And Salmon gives this example. This is Salmon quite late in his career, by the way. For a long time before this, he was a marked transmission theorist and really just a theorist of influence, I think. And before that, he was not such a fan of causation in general. So third wave Salmon. So imagine some people playing baseball. Even those of us who grew up in other countries and never played baseball come to the US and get taught philosophy and begin to think of baseball as the paradigmatic conveyor of causal relations. I guess that's what soft power is all about. So there are these people playing baseball. Ball goes astray, hits a window, the window breaks. The causal influences on the breaking, as Salmon would say, the things that transmit their mark to the broken window, include the ball, of course. But also, as Salmon points out, the shouts of the players. So the players are yelling at one another. Those shouts are setting up vibrations, or they are vibrations in the air. Those vibrations are communicated to the window pane, and the window pane is itself vibrating because of the sounds. But in the way things usually pan out, of course, between the ball and the shouts, we think of causal responsibility very differently. Okay, what we do is we ask ourselves when we're thinking causally such questions as what makes a difference to, or what made a difference in this case, to the windows breaking? The answer, in this case, obviously, the ball made a difference. The shouts did not. Okay, so Salmon told this story in order to explain what was missing from his marked transmission theory. I guess this is partly in response to Chris Hitchcock's influence on him. He said, indeed. So whatever difference making it is, it has to be something Chris can do. Salmon said, we need some additional criterion if we're going to understand in this case, perhaps as much for the sake of explanation as for causation, this distinction we make between the ball and the shouts. Now let me say a few things about what this difference-making has to be. First of all, it relates typically high-level events, or at least when we talk about it does. So the things to which you make a difference are such things as a window's breaking. By a high-level event, I mean an event that the same, very same event could have happened in many different ways. Okay, the precise trajectories of the shards from the broken window, if they were a little bit different, that event of the window's breaking would still have occurred. Okay, so it's a quite robust occurrence, and a thing that might well have occurred if many things had gone slightly differently. The breaking of windows, the changing of moods, the evolution of violence and death. All of these things are high-level events. And when we think about what makes a difference, we're typically thinking of things at this kind of level. Now take one of those events, one of these high-level events. Any influence, or maybe almost any influence, causal influence on that event, will determine to some degree, maybe a very, very, very tiny degree, how the event occurs, how it unfolds, exactly which direction those shards take as the window shatters. Okay. The difference makers, though, are the things that determine whether or not the event occurs, whether or not the window breaks. Okay. Now you can see why I made that distinction between the high-level events that can occur in many different ways. Okay. So a difference maker determines that high-level event occurs rather than not occurring, and influence determines exactly how that high-level event occurs. But if it's not a difference maker, it doesn't determine that it occurs or that it doesn't occur. When you're thinking this way, it's good to think of difference makers as properties, not things. So I started out with the ball, the baseball, as an example of a difference maker. But really, the way you should think of it is that certain properties of the ball are difference makers. The fact that it hit the window with sufficient force, that's a difference maker. The fact that it hit this very place on the window with this exact force, not such a difference maker, because if the place and the force had just been slightly different, the window would still have broken. So these, the exact place, the exact velocity, those are influences that don't make a difference. They determine how the window breaks, but not that it breaks. Okay. Likewise, it's facts about the structure of the window that are going to be part of this story. Okay, so how do you figure out what the difference makers are? I have a particular story about this. I'm going to tell you the story in a super compressed form in a single slide and then mention the fact that there are other ways to tell the story as well. Because I want to give you my story because it's very clear on my story that what you're doing here is something very different from determining which things are influences or not. On the other hand, for the general two-aspect theory of causation, it's not necessary to buy into my story in particular. Although, this week only, it's going for 50% off. Okay, so here's my story, first of all. Do this. Represent the causal web, the entire structure of causal influence relations, as a deductive argument. Okay, it's a little bit crazy to think that you could actually do this, but what we're trying to do here is define a criterion for what counts as a difference maker, not giving practical advice on how to figure out what the difference makers are. So imagine the whole thing laid out in beautiful mathematical physics, if necessary, right from the beginning of the universe to the end, with a little red circle around the bits that constitute the breaking of the window. Okay, we're gonna, of course, focus in on those. Now, there'll be a kind of deductive structure to this physical model, at least the kind of model I have in mind. If you want to use a different kind of model, that's fine. But deduction is so general and so central to mathematical physics, it seems like a natural choice. The idea is that this deductive structure should mirror the causal influence relations. So what you're doing is taking, in these deductions, you're taking causal influences as premises, fundamental laws as premises, major premises, if you like, you're deducing effects. That deduction, the idea is a kind of representation of the influence relation. Okay. Then what? Then what you want to do, now you have this deductive argument to the effect that the event occurred, the window broke, something that Hempel would recognize as a deductive nomological explanation, except something that also satisfies this extra condition that the whole thing mirrors the direction of causal influence, and in fact, the particular causal influence relations. Okay. Once you have that, you then perform a kind of abstraction relation on it. What you want to do is take all the information out of that argument you can without invalidating the entailment of the occurrence of the event, and also without violating that requirement that the entailment mirror the causal influence structure. Okay? Do that, and what's left are difference makers. So take the complete physical story about the breaking of the window. Remove all the details that you don't need to get the entailment of the windows actually breaking. You'll be removing, among other things, the information about exactly where the ball hit, and leaving behind only information about approximately where it hit. You'll be removing information about how hard it hit, and leaving in information about approximately how hard it hit, and so on. Okay. What you're left with then is a rather abstract or high-level description of the process. That's the description that picks out properties that are difference makers. Actually, it won't necessarily pick out all the difference makers. You may have to repeat a few times to get them all, but it will give you only difference makers. Okay. In this simple case, it either spells them all out or at least implies what they are. Okay. Now, I foreshadowed this a moment ago. Think this is a definition of what it is to be a difference maker. It's not advice to the scientist. We have lots of tests for difference making that we use. What we're testing for is satisfaction of this definition. We don't have to use the definition to do the test. In particular, nobody is ever going to sit down and write out the complete physical story about why something occurred. And in fact, we really don't have the resources to complete or the specification of the initial conditions for infinitely many significant figures after the decimal point. So we're well advised not to do it that way. But if we can see the story is going to come out in a certain way, we're pretty good at this. Okay, now, as I mentioned, there are other ways of thinking about difference making. There's probabilistic relevance, for example. This is Salmon's route to deciding it was the ball and not the shouts of the ball players that were the difference makers. Okay, I think you can construct various kinds of counterfactual dependence tests, and, including, for example, there's a kind of way of adapting the interventionist apparatus to pick out difference makers here. Notice, though, that although people have given probabilistic relevance accounts of causation and, of course, counterfactual dependence accounts of causation, what the apparatus is doing here is not taking non-causal facts and telling you which are the causes. Rather, they're taking fundamental-level causal facts, the causal influence facts, and telling you which of those facts are difference makers. So it's not a metaphysics of causation in the sense that it tells you what the fundamental stuff of causation is, although it is in some sense, a metaphysics of the high-level difference-making relation. It's telling you when you have certain difference-making relations, given what foundations. So we can distinguish alongside the causal web, the web of influence, fundamental causal reality, the various networks of high-level difference-making. Okay, these are going to be, compared to the web, relatively sparse, okay, or at least relatively simple, which is not to say they'll actually be simple. There'll be different networks for different levels of description. Okay, there'll be for the breaking of the window, there'll be one network of difference makers, but then there'll be a slightly more detailed network of difference makers for a slightly more detailed event of the windows breaking dramatically, say. Okay, that network will have to include in the details that made a difference between a dramatic shattering and a simple, quiet falling apart. Okay, so there'll be many, many layers. Just as there are many layers of high-level event, there's the the very concrete event. There's the event of the window breaking dramatically. There's simply the event of the window breaking. There's the event of something breaking. There's the event of something happening. For each of these different levels of description, there may well be different layers of difference making. So the network makes up, as it were, in its multiplicity of layers for what it lacks, what the web has in terms of denseness of causal connections. All right. So now you should be beginning to see the relation between these two kinds of causal relations. A lot of things, a lot of exciting parts of the philosophy of causation, I think, only come along with the introduction of difference making. So if we just did the philosophy of the building blocks of causation, if we just did the philosophy of influence, if all we cared about were coming up with philosophical theories that captured the connectivity of the web, there's a lot of issues that a lot of problems we simply wouldn't have to solve. Okay, we wouldn't have to say anything about high-level causation, about whether something counts as something that influences the window actually counts as a cause of the window. Of course, I don't think a whole practice of giving singular causal claims, C was a cause of E, that's all about difference making. Here is some more esoteric stuff. I started thinking about this stuff not because I was set out to be a thinker about causation or a metaphysician of anything at all, but because I was interested in scientific explanation. I think with this notion of high-level difference-making come a whole suite of explanatory practices which abstract away from what's going on causally to a greater degree, while still functioning precisely because they tell you something about the fundamental level causal goings on. Equilibrium explanation in biology or economics or even physics leaves out a lot of details, leaves out a story about how you get to the equilibrium state, but still I think is a high level description of a certain sort of causal process. The use of probability to explain in deterministic systems, or at least in systems that for all we know are deterministic, such as, for example, stochastic models in evolutionary biology, or even maybe in statistical physics. Also a case, although it doesn't look like it on the surface, of causal abstraction, where telling a causal story that leaves in just those pieces of the story that are needed to get you the high-level event you're trying to explain, so that the system ended up in an equilibrium state in the case of equilibrium explanation, or that events occurred with a certain frequency in the case of stochastic explanation. Okay. And causation by omission. Okay. So there's a contrast to be drawn here, but between what I call two-factor and one-factor theories of causation. A one-factor theory is what most theories of causation look to be. So there's a single kind of causal relation, there's a single story to be told about when it's true that C is causally connected to E. On the kind of two-factor theory I'm giving here, there's two parts to the story. There's only one kind of causal reality, but there's two parts to the story of what we're talking about when we talk about causation. In my telling, we're almost always talking about the high-level sort, but still, there's one kind that's different from the rest, that's both physically low-level and metaphysically low-level, being the foundation. And that's the thing that everything else is resting on. So I'll conclude by just saying a little bit more about the two-factor picture and then stopping. So we now have on the table, as Hall suggests, two kinds of causal relation. A fundamental level relation of causal influence, and that's local intrinsic transitive, and a high-level relation of causal difference-making, which can connect such states of affairs as absences. We have two levels of discourse to go along with that. There's the physical level, where we're talking about causal influence. This is what metaphysicists do. Maybe it's what we're doing some of the time when we are putting together our causal models in physics. And then there's the difference-making relation, Okay, whereas the influence relation is the raw, the difference-making relation is the cooked. It's we've taken the raw stuff and we've used it to create some further facts, totally dependent facts at the high level. And actually, there's really a third level, which I mention, but I won't say anything further about. There's only one kind of causal stuff. Everything causal is made of causal influence. We almost never talk about causal influence. Singular causal claims, type causal claims, this kind of thing affects that kind of thing. Okay. Explanatory claims, all high level, all claims about the difference-making relation. Okay. So there's a kind of a, there's two asymmetries here. Metaphysically, causal influence is everything. In what we talk about and care about, causal difference-making is everything, or almost everything. Why this concern with difference-making? Well, simply because in our lives, what we care about are relatively high-level events. Birth, death, falling in love, publication. These are the things that matter to us. Okay. The precise details, not so important. Okay. So what we're concerned with is not the entirety of the causal web of influence, but the aspects of the structure that make a difference in some sense to whether these high-level events occur. And this is my story. Not three in one, that's for God alone, but two in one. The one, a single causal substance, causal influence, and then plus one on top, the practically important features of the web, of that substance, of the structure of that substance that make a difference in our lives. Okay, this is all written up in a paper coming out, well, I don't know when it's going to come out actually, but you can find it on my website, called Causality Reunified, if you're happy to, if you're interested in looking further, and thank you for listening.